Hello, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards. In this episode, a conversation with IMF Chief Economist Morris Obstfeld about the latest world economic outlook, which shows global growth is on the rise.
So what is behind this recent upswing in growth rates?
Back in the first half of 2016, we were in fact quite worried about the global economy. Financial markets were in turmoil, commodity prices had plummeted, growth seemed to be slowing. And somewhere in the second half of that year, around the middle of the year, growth started picking up, and it has continued to pick up. And in line with that, we have continually raised our forecasts of global growth. And in fact, we now see a recovery that encompasses about 75% of world GDP.
But does this come as a surprise, or could you sort of foresee this last year? Could you see the beginnings of this?
Well, you know, as Yogi Berra once said, prediction is hard, especially about the future. Mm. And, you know, we did have a debate about whether this was something that was going to be sustained. We still debate how sustained this will be. So, you know, I wouldn't say that we look in our crystal ball and foresee this, but we look at the real-time data as it comes in, take the advice of the desks on what's going on in their economies, and we try to make an assessment of the future. And in this case, it's turned out that, you know, the assessments we started making in the second half of 2016, that things were accelerating, that led us to first stabilize and then increase our growth forecasts have been correct. And we have been gradually upgrading. What explains it? Well, usually you need a confluence of many factors in many countries to get to the sort of sweet spot we seem to be in now. We see confidence having gone up, business confidence, consumer confidence. We see purchasing managers' indices being higher. We see investment higher in a number of countries. We see growing world trade. We are coming off of a long period of continuing very easy global financial conditions. The fiscal retrenchment that we saw in some recent years is at the very least on pause. So, you know, a lot of factors have been driving this cyclical upswing. It's taken us a while to get comfortable with it, but we now think it has legs. We therefore view the medium-term risks as still being present and being skewed to the downside. But in the short term, we see risks being very evenly balanced. And we think that this is therefore a good time for policymakers to really think about how they can use this upswing to their advantage.
But some of the things that one would expect to come with higher growth rates, like higher wages, are just not happening. Why is that?
Well, this is one of the puzzles of the recovery. And in fact, we devote a chapter to this, chapter two, in the new World Economic Outlook, to look at the slow nominal wage growth, which has been something we've seen not only in the U.S., but across advanced economies. The analysis points to a number of factors. First of all, we see low productivity growth. Now, in economies where unemployment remains above the pre-global financial crisis average, this is a factor, but it's a factor that's on a par with the continuing existence of labor market slack and considerable part-time unemployment. Whereas in countries where unemployment rates are now below those before the global crisis, and productivity was actually higher before the global crisis, productivity is a bigger factor than slack, although slack is still an issue. Also at play are expectations of low inflation, which feed into nominal wage growth as well.
And when you say slack, you mean sort of this involuntary part-time work. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, we see increases pretty much everywhere in involuntary part-time work, where, you know, basically defined by workers working less than 30 hours a week and responding yes to the question, you know, would you like to work more at current wages? We also see other indicators of what might be weakness in labor market conditions, or that you could interpret as deterioration in conditions of employment. For example, the incidence of temporary contracts has gone up. Workers are working fewer hours. Now, these kinds of numbers are hard to interpret, because it could be that workers simply like the flexibility of part-time work more than they did in the past, or like the flexibility of temporary contracts or the gig economy. But given the correlation of these factors with low growth in wages and with the increase in involuntary part-time unemployment, where we know the workers would like to work more, we suspect that part of it is a general deterioration in working conditions, which is very consistent with the tepid wage behavior we've seen.
And so what does that say about productivity? I mean, you mentioned productivity before, but are part-time workers less productive than full-time workers?
You know, I'm not sure what the latest micro evidence would show, but, you know, one would expect that there could be productivity effects from a prevalence of short-term contracts or part-time work. Not necessarily, but that could be the case. You know, it could be that firms have less incentive to do on-the-job training if they're, you know, explicitly short-term contracts. I think one intriguing idea that hasn't been looked at a lot is the idea of the efficiency wage theory, which is a view that was put forth in the 80s by Joe Stiglitz and George Akerlof and Janet Yellen. Others wrote about this, where the basic idea is that workers who get paid a little more than what they could get elsewhere in the market, or who have somewhat better working conditions, might put in more effort so they keep those really good jobs. And in that sense, if wages are lower, there may be less incentive to put in effort on the job and lower productivity. Now, you know, on the other hand, you know, we do see a much less dynamic labor market, in which workers are apparently less willing to go out and search for jobs. There's less dynamism, less new firms. All of this is also weighing on wages and could affect the calculations of workers about, you know, how much effort to put into their jobs.
And do you think that weak wage growth feeds into this rising anti-globalization sentiment?
Well, it's been interesting that we've seen the sentiment both on the left and on the right of the political spectrum. And I do think that weak wage growth has been an issue. You know, we looked in last October's WIO at labor share of income across advanced and emerging economies, and certainly across advanced economies where the anti-globalization sentiment is strongest. This has not really changed that much since before the 2000s. But there's been a much longer period of stagnant median wage growth. I mean, in the U.S., the last couple of years, median real wages have risen. But, you know, for almost a generation before that, they've been pretty much flat. So I think that this idea that people kind of lose hope for improvement in the future, you know, less hope for your own future or for your children's future, fuels resentment. They see a process of opening. They see firms that are able to move internationally. That has caused some disillusionment. And of course, much of what has happened is due to technology, not to trade, but trade becomes an obvious scapegoat.
And so The fund has focused very intently on issues related to income inequality in recent years. Is there anything in this World Economic Outlook that sheds some light on why inequality continues to rise?
Well, it's a good question whether it's actually continuing to rise or not, and what the future path is. Certainly, what we're seeing in wage behavior now in advanced economies would suggest that we're not seeing any broad-based reductions in inequality. It might be a better description to say that inequality, has risen. It's higher in some countries than in others. In the U.S., among advanced economies, it's exceptionally high, and it also depends how you measure it. But we've been working on inequality in the fund for a while. I would say at least since the early part of this decade. So it's become a very, very important agenda for us. And I think our view is that it's possible to support inclusiveness, to support globalization, with reforms that also support the fluidity of labor markets, that increase the level of educational investments, and that will actually ultimately raise potential output and market functioning. But I think one of the things we're seeing and that we've learned as a result of recent political events is that a very potent potential channel for inequality to affect growth is through its impact on politics and the attitude toward not just international trade, but expertise, sound economic advice, and the like.
So do you think that people are having or losing confidence in economists to sort of guide them?
Well, I'm not sure they ever had much confidence in economists, but I think it's clear that it's become much easier to push back, and we as a group certainly I think lost some credibility after the global financial crisis. We didn't see it coming. Our remedies have led to a very, very drawn out recovery. And while some of the criticism is unfair, and while we have learned from the experience, and I think our policy advice now is sounder, we certainly have taken a hit. But that's not to say there hasn't always been skepticism. I mean, there was the famous quip of President Truman about give me a one-handed economist. President Johnson, when presented with a range of estimates by his economic advisor, was said to have responded, ranges are for cattle, give me a number. So we do hedge our bets. We recognize there's uncertainty. When we don't do that, we're often wrong, and so we're sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't.
So another issue that's taken on prominence at the fund over the past few years is climate change. Mm-hmm. And in this World Economic Outlook, you speak of low-income countries. What is it about issues like that low-income countries are especially troubled with?
Well, they are very unimportant contributors to the global emissions problem. And this is really coming from advanced economies and emerging markets. So even if they cut their emissions, which is very hard for them to do, by the way, it doesn't matter much. So they really need to adapt. They're on the front lines of where the any sort of global temperature increases will have the biggest impact, because they already have high temperatures. The evidence that we have shows that the effects of even higher temperatures are particularly negative. Whereas if you're in a temperate zone, the effect of moderately higher temperatures may not be that great and could even be positive. And for some places like northern Canada or Siberia, possibly quite positive in percentage terms. But of course, you know, GDP in those areas is close to zero. So a large percentage increase is not very much of an absolute change.
So there are countries that are poised to potentially benefit from the effects of climate change.
I wouldn't make too much of that, though, because here we're speaking only about the sort of raw effects of temperature on output. And there are many other ways in which climate change will affect countries. And, you know, coming back to low-income economies, in many cases, they're challenged because they are, not all of them by any means, but many of them are commodity exporters. Commodity prices have been weaker, so their longer-term growth rates have gone down. One of the things we find is that, you know, macroeconomic policy buffers actually help, whether it's your international reserves, having a flexible exchange rate, having low public debt, having bigger foreign aid inflows. And many of these countries are also disadvantaged in that respect. There are serious governance issues in some of them, which prevent them from either getting the fiscal resources or effectively deploying those to make investments in adaptation. And finally, one of the pretty robust findings of the literature is that in warm countries particularly, higher temperatures, climate change is associated with greater civil conflict. And so you do see the possibility of more mass migrations and more political instability, which would definitely spill over to the advanced economies. So we really are all in this together. And, you know, it is in the interest of advanced economies to help low-income economies invest in resilience, to try to reduce their own emissions, to keep temperature rises down, and to take this problem very seriously.
That was Moritz Obstfeld, Chief Economist and Director of Research at the International Monetary Fund, talking about the latest World Economic Outlook, now published on imf.org. You can also read blogs by Obstfeld and fellow economists on all three of the WEO's analytical chapters at blogs.imf.org. And if you like this podcast, search for IMF Podcasts on iTunes or your favorite podcast app and subscribe. And if you need to get in touch, send us an email at imfpodcasts@imf.org.